Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here speaking with you today. we're going to talk about Jacob this morning, and I had the reading change to the first reading for the day. We've been looking at Jacob and his life in the first reading, and I think he's a character that I find it easy to relate to. And it's one of these cases where you have a man of faith, a man of God, someone that God clearly chose and worked with and selected, but someone whom we're given a special insight into his weaknesses and the struggles that he had and the path and the journey that he had as God worked with him in transforming him to be a man of God. So just a brief little bit of review about the chapter 30 there. We're going to look at the second half of chapter 30 and some of what had come before that as well. We know that Jacob had served Laban for many years. He had been tricked into serving a total of 14 years for both of his wives. And then we see here in this chapter and the previous chapter, he has enough time to have, I think it's 11 children, 11 sons at least, and one daughter. So presumably there was probably other daughters that weren't mentioned that also happened during that time. So he's been with Laban for a long time, and Jacob demonstrates his faith in the promises that were made both to his father and to him when he comes to Laban and says, "I'd like to leave." And the reason he demonstrates faith there is because he's having faith in the promises that God had made to him, that land, Canaan, would be his land and his children's land. So Laban begs him to stay, right? Laban knows that he's been really blessed because Jacob is there. And we won't go into sort of, I think there's a little story there in and of itself. Laban sort of says by divination, he knows that, which is a little story in and of itself. But so Laban says, "What can I do to make you stay?" And Jacob agrees on the condition that he'll get these speckled sheep. These brown sheep that are perhaps probably undesirable to Laban. And I think his motivations here are interesting because he says he wants to do it because there'll be no doubt about his honesty, right? So his flock will have only brown, speckled, or striped sheep, and so there'll be no doubt about whether or not he's stolen the sheep from Laban. And then Jacob separates those 3 days' journey, and Jacob uses these striped rods, right? So he has these striped rods that he sets up in front of the sheep, and he has sort of a rotation that he uses for the healthiest, strongest sheep, that he uses those rods when those sheep come in, and when the weak sheep come in, he doesn't. And this is his sort of attempt to get the sheep to produce speckled or off-color sheep that can then move into his herd. So I guess the question here is, was that faithful, right? Was this exchange and was this sort of event, as it exists as a whole, was it an evidence of Jacob's faith? Was it a faithful activity that he did with the rods, selectively breeding the herd? Was all of this faithful, right? So we want to come back to that question. And I think we'll start off looking at Hebrews 11. So if we could turn there, we'll take a look, and this will be review for all of us, I think. But we'll look at Hebrews chapter 11, and we'll look at what is faith. So Hebrews chapter 11, starting at verse 1, and we'll just read verse 1. Now from the King James Version it reads, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." In the NIV it says, "Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see." So I think a lot of times I think about faith and I think about God immediately. But I think this is a concept that is pervasive in our own lives, and it's a powerful force in our own lives. We think about a lot of the things that we do in our lives, and it's all based around faith. So we pull up to a traffic light, and if that traffic light is green, we proceed through without a whole lot of thought to anything else. So there we have faith that the system is working properly and that there's a red light facing the other directions that we can't see as we're approaching by design, and that the people who are sitting on the other side of that red light understand what that means and are going to stop. None of that's happened yet, but we have faith that that event that has not yet happened will in fact happen, and so we speed through the green light at our current speed without giving it much thought. Our alarm clocks. We set our alarm clocks most nights to wake up the next day at a certain time so that we can go about the events of our lives. Now, unless you've had some sort of mishap with your alarm clock where you're, you know, having some lack of faith in it, for the most part, you have faith that your alarm clock's going to go off at the time you set it to go off, and it will wake you up in time to get done with the activities that you have to do during that day. So there's another small example of faith in our everyday lives. Our paychecks, for those of us that work, you go in, and typically work doesn't pay you as you go. You get a paycheck at the end of the week, at the end of 2 weeks, maybe at the end of the month, for work that you have already done. So you work having faith that your employer will then compensate you for the work that you've given. So this is another form of faith. Another really simple one, the light switch, right? You go to a light switch, you turn it on, you expect that the light will come on. You have faith in the electric grid. You have faith in the light bulb and the wiring in your own house, right? So these are things that, just really simple examples of faith, but they're meant to show, really, like what I said in the beginning of this sort of conversation, that it's not a concept that's relegated to the Bible, and that every time our belief in the veracity of something unseen prompts an action on our part, that is an example of faith acting in our lives. So we talked about sort of faith in general, but why faith in God? So if you look down a few verses in Hebrews, right, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6, it says, "But without faith, it is impossible to please him, God. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him." So first off, we have to have faith that God exists, and not just exists, but exists in the form as he's expressed himself in his word, the all-powerful, all-knowing, ever-existing God. And the second thing that it says there is that we have to have faith that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. So what does it mean that God is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him? What has he promised to those that believe in him, that seek after him, that try to be like him? In Matthew, and I'll just sort of talk about this one, I think it's a story that's familiar to all of us, God promises to care for our physical needs. And this is via Jesus and his words. And Jesus says, talks about the lilies of the field and how they're clothed and how much care God takes for all of the birds and the different pieces of nature. And what he says to his disciples is, don't worry about what you're going to eat or what you're going to wear or what you're going to drink. He says, if you seek first the kingdom of God, all these things will be added unto you. So that's one of the promises that God has made to his followers. If you have faith and believe, that's one of the promises he's made to us, is that he will take care of our physical needs in this life. Another promise that God's made to his followers is that he'll take care of our spiritual needs in this life, and that he will help us to grow and to be more like him. In Romans, it says that we know that to them that love God, all things work together for good, even to them that are called according to his purpose. We know that in Corinthians, it talks about not being tempted beyond what we can bear, that God will always provide a way of escape. And so we see that he promises to be there for us in our spiritual journey as well, and to give to us in the events of our lives learnings and development to help us be more like him. And he's promised that we will live in perfection with him forever if we strive towards this goal. Jesus talks to the Sadducees, and he says that we'll be like the angels when we are raised, if we are judged worthy. So I think these are some of the promises that we look at, that if we have faith in God, these are the promises that he talks about, being a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. These are the promises that he's made, the rewards that he's offered. But what does this mean to have faith? So if we could turn to James, we'll look at some more familiar verses in James chapter 2. James chapter 2, and we'll just read from 14 to verse 18. I think really 14 to the end of the to the end of the chapter is really good, but for time's sake, we'll pick up 14 to 18 here. "What use is it, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but has no works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, 'Go in peace, be warmed and be filled,' and yet you do not give them what is necessary for their body, what use is that? Even so, faith, if it has no works, is dead, being by itself. But someone may well say, 'You have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith without the works, and I will show you my faith by my works.'" So, first off, let's consider our previous examples of faith. So, consider for a moment in our daily life, if we didn't have faith, that the traffic light was in fact red on the other side, and that everyone on the other side of that knew what that meant and was going to follow the rules. Well, we would behave very differently. We would probably stop at every intersection and sort of make sure that that we would be able to go through, and then sort of cautiously proceed once we had verified the situation. The alarm clock, right? And this one may be a real example for some of us that, you know, we may not have faith that our alarm clock is going to go off in the morning, And so we may have some sort of backup plan, right? Some other method to wake ourselves up if we didn't have that faith. And again, the paycheck, you know, if we didn't have faith or we had no reason to believe that our employer would pay us at the end of the month, the week, the 2 weeks, whatever it is, we would come to some other agreement with that employer where maybe we got part of the pay up front or had some sort of definite contract or something that really bound the both of us to this thing where we would get paid. So if that's the litmus test for faith is these actions, what actually happens in our lives, God wants us to show our faith by acting like him, as explained by his son and as demonstrated by his son. So it's not enough to say that we simply believe in the promises of God's care. Each one of those promises was contingent upon us actively pursuing to be like God. We can't just wait sort of motionless expecting God to deliver on his promises. God requires that we demonstrate our faith in his promises through actions that are motivated by that faith. But I think, of course, this is always a discussion we have in Christadelphia, and there's always two sides to this coin, and I think there's a real balance here because our sort of wiring, right, is that if we do something, there's this thing called pride that comes into it, right? And as soon as we've done something, suddenly we feel like we have accomplished it. And so there's a real balance between trying to keep our natural tendency to have this sense of accomplishment at bay and recognizing that God is truly the source of our successes. Of course, maybe there's the case where our motivations are not that clear to begin with. Perhaps we just didn't have a lot of faith right off the bat. So maybe there's the case where we asked God for help, but also we kind of hedged our bets. And we kind of had another plan going at the same time. We were doing our own thing, but at the same time sort of asking God, please help me with whatever this is. Right? Or perhaps there's even another case where we've forgotten God altogether in the decision we're making and we're doing something. And then we sort of, as an afterthought, almost as a superstition, you know, oh, I know I'm already headed this direction, but God, can you bless this activity, right? So I think there's sort of varying degrees of this, and I think it's a really difficult balance that takes, I would say, a lifetime to even come close to getting right. And I think that's where we start to look at Jacob, who had this progression over his entire lifetime. And I think what we see with him is he progresses from a man who thinks he can do it all on his own to a man who thinks he can do it with God's help, to a man who thinks he can't do it, and he needs God. I think we see the man who thought he could do it on his own when he tricks Esau out of his birthright. He thinks that through his own actions, somehow he can bring about the will of God and trick him into giving up his birthright with this broth. And we see him working with his mother, a man who thinks he can do it on his own, who needs to bring about these things on his own, when he tricks Isaac into giving the blessing to him instead of Esau. At the end of his life, or rather, probably closer to the middle of his life, we see a man who transforms and becomes completely reliant on God, who realizes he can't do it on his own. He wrestles with the angel and doesn't let the angel go until he has a commitment that God will be with him. And he gets a name change, and God gives him a permanent physical reminder that he can't do it. He fractures his hip, or he damages his hip in such a way that he limps from that day forward. So I think what we saw today in chapter 30 is sort of this man in the middle, this man who thinks that he can do it, but he needs God's help too. Or maybe he's kind of hedging his bets. He had the right motivations for his decision, clearly. He wanted to be honest, right? He wanted to have transparency in his decision and the results of that decision so that the sheep that were different color would be obviously his, and the sheep that were the white color would be obviously Laban's. And I think clearly it took some faith and belief that God was on his side to offer this deal to Laban to make this decision. I think Laban would have bred his herd for the same color sheep that could be used for, when sheared, could be used for clothing and different things and wouldn't sort of have this multiple colors to it. The white fur would be easy to dye and to make different colors out of that would be appealing to the eye. So I think, these speckled sheep probably wouldn't have been in great supply within the herd, or at least you wouldn't have expected them to be. So I think it took some faith on his part, also, in addition to having the right motivations to make this decision. And yet we still see that when it comes down to the rubber meeting the road, Jacob doesn't just tend the herd and be a responsible steward of Laban's flock and let God decide how things will work out and have total faith in God, he sort of hedges his bets, right? He has this strategy with the striped rods that he uses, and this rotation that he uses for the stronger sheep to bring in front of the speckled rods when these sheep are mating, and to sort of not do that when the weak sheep are mating. And so we kind of see this man who, while he had faith in God, he also kind of had his own strategy, just in case, right? And this is my own interpretation. So if this is not the way you read it, my apologies. So there are other ways to interpret this story. And you know, while I was reading about it, there are other ways to look at, you know, what the decisions that Jacob made and sort of put different motives on it. So bear with me for the moment if you disagree with my analysis here of what was going through Jacob's mind, because I know there are some different ways to look at this, and I have definitely imposed upon Jacob a little bit here my interpretation of what he was probably thinking. But, you know, we see that in the following chapter, in chapter 31, in hindsight, Jacob does give the credit to God. So clearly there's this man, as I see it, this man struggling with his faith, right? Sort of, I believe in God, and I have faith that God can do it for me, but I'm going to hedge my bets. I'm going to do something over here as well, right? It's not just strict faith in God. And so I think the lesson for us here is that we all go through this struggle. We all go through this tugging and pulling between what we feel naturally and what God has asked us to do. God has asked us to have complete and total faith in Him and to let our actions be driven by that faith. And yet we have this sin nature within us that drives our actions as well, or wants to drive our actions as well. And we have this competition between the two. And I think what's encouraging here is that we see this took a lifetime, in my terms anyway, for Jacob. I mean, Jacob probably, I don't know how old he was when he went to Laban, but he was probably fairly old when he went to Laban, at least a man, right, what we would consider a full-grown man. He goes to Laban and he spends, I don't know, maybe 20, 30 years with Laban, you know, on this journey. And when he goes to finally meet Esau is when he says, God, I need you. I can't do this, right? And he hangs on to that angel until he gets the promise. And so what we see here is God patiently working over many, many years with Jacob. And I think that's a really powerful lesson for me as I read through this, and I hope for all of us, that this isn't something you ever get right away. And it's something you just keep trying at, right? And God will be patient with us. God will work with us over the course of our lives to help transform us, to help get closer to a point where our actions are motivated by that true and pure faith that God will be true to His promises, and that He does love us and will care for us, and that we will slowly, through God's power, learn to push out, right, the sin nature that wants to drive our actions, that wants to motivate us. So I think we're here this morning, obviously, to remember the perfect manifestation of this faith in action. We're here to remember Jesus, who allowed His faith to so perfectly drive His actions. There was no ego, there was no I accomplished when Jesus did things. It was all, this is the will of God. God has accomplished this through me. And we see that His faith never wavered in what God was offering to Him, what God had promised Him. And He took that all the way to the cross, and in pure faith and completely convicted that God would raise Him to His right hand, that God would make Him the prince that He had promised. And so we see here the bread and the wine symbolizing His life, completely given as an act of faith, as a complete and total conviction and belief in God and what God had offered, and that His body was broken at the end of His life in the most ultimate expression of faith, that He would give His life believing completely that God would raise Him. And so that is how that opportunity has been opened for us, that if we continue to build our faith and continue to work towards what Jesus was, that we too can be offered that life, that perfect life with God and with Jesus.